This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents
The Kitchen House by Kathleen Grissom. For my beloved parents, Ted and Catherine Depker, and for my dear mentor, Eleanor Drury Dolan. Prologue, 1810, Lavinia. There was a strong smell of smoke, and new fear fueled me. Now on the familiar path I raced ahead, unmindful of my daughter behind me, trying to keep up. My legs were numb, unused to this speed, and my lungs felt as though they were scorched. I forbade myself to think I was too late, and focused all my strength on moving toward home. Foolishly I misjudged, and meaning to take a shortcut to the stream, I swerved from the path to dash through the trees. To my horror I found myself trapped. I pulled to free my long blue skirts from the blackberry brambles that ensnared me. As I ripped my way out, Ellie caught up to me. She attached herself to my arm, sobbing and trying to hold me back. Though a 7-year-old is no match for a grown woman, she fought fiercely, with strength fostered by her own terror. In my frenzy, I pushed her to the ground. She stared at me with disbelieving eyes. "Stay here," I begged, and raced back down the path until I reached the stream. I meant to cross over by stepping on the rocks in the shallow water, but I didn't remove my shoes, which was a mistake. Halfway over, I slipped on the river stones, and with a splash I fell. The cold water shocked me, and for a moment I sat stunned, water bubbling by, until I looked up and recognized our smokehouse on the other side of the stream. The gray building reminded me that I was close to home. I rose, my skirts soaked and heavy, and scrambled my way across the water by clinging to the jutting rocks. At the base of the hill, I leaned forward to breathe, gasping for air. Somehow, Ellie had reached my side again, and this time she clung like a kitten to my wet skirts. I was terrified of what she might see, but it was too late now, so I grasped her hand, and together we crested the bluff. There, I froze. Ellie saw it too, and whimpered. Her hand slipped from mine as she sat on the ground. I moved forward slowly, as though in a dream. Our massive oak tree stood at the top of the hill, its lush green leaves shading the thick branch that bore the weight of the hanging body. I refused to look up again after I caught sight of the green headscarf and the handmade shoes that pointed down. Chapter 1, 1791, Lavinia. In that spring of 1791, I did not understand that the trauma of loss had taken my memory. I knew only that after I woke, wedged between crates and bags, I was terror-stricken to discover that I did not know where I was, nor could I recall my name. I was frail after months of rough travel, and when the man lifted me from the wagon, I clung to his broad shoulders. He was having none of that, and easily pulled my arms loose to set me down. I began to cry, and reached back up for him, but he pushed me instead toward the old Negro male who was hurrying toward us.
"Jacob, take her," the man said. "Give her to Belle. She's hers for the kitchen." "Yes, Cap'n."
The old man kept his eyes low.
"James! James, you're home!"
A woman's call. Hopeful, I stared up at the enormous house in front of me. It was made of clapboard and painted white, and a wide porch framed the full length of the front. Towering columns circled with vines of green and violet wisteria stood on either side of the broad front steps, and the air was thick with the fragrance this early April morning.
"James, why didn't you send word?"
the woman sang out into the morning mist. Hands on his hips, the man leaned back for a better view.
"I warn you, wife, I've come home for you. Best come down before I come up."
Above, at a window that appeared open to the floor, she laughed, a figure of white froth capped by billowing auburn hair. Oh, no, James. You stay away until you've been washed.
Mrs. Park, prepare yourself,
he shouted, and bounded over the threshold. Inside, he continued to shatter the peace.
Where is everyone?
I heard him call.
I'm home.
At a run, I began to follow, but the dark old man caught my arm and held me. When I fought him, he lifted me up, and I screamed in terror. Swiftly, he carried me to the back of the house. We were high on a hill, and out farther, lesser hills surrounded us. A horn blasted, frightening me further, and I began to hit at my captor. He shook me firmly.
You stop this now!
I stared at him, at his foreign dark brown skin that contrasted so with his white hair, and his dialect so strange that I scarcely understood.
What you fighting me for?
He asked. I was exhausted by it all and dropped my head on the man's thin shoulder. He continued on to the kitchen house.
Bill?
The old man called.
Bill!
Uncle Jacob, come in.
A feminine voice called, and the wooden door creaked as he pushed it open with his foot. Uncle Jacob slid me to my feet while a young woman came slowly down the stairs, then came forward, quickly tying a band of green calico around a thick braid of glossy black hair. Her large green eyes grew wide in disbelief as she took me in. I was comforted to see that she was not as foreign-looking as the man who had brought me to her, for though her light brown skin still differed from mine, her facial features more resembled my own. Uncle Jacob spoke.
The captain sent this child to you. He say she for the kitchen house. What's that man thinking?
Can't he see she's white?
The woman sank in front of me and turned me around.
You been sick?
She wrinkled her nose.
I've got to burn these clothes. You nothing but bones. You want something to eat?
She pried my thumb from my mouth and asked if I could speak. I could find no voice and looked around trying to place myself. Belle went to the enormous fireplace that stretched the length of the room. There she poured steaming milk into a wooden mug. When she held it to my mouth, I choked on the milk, and my body began an involuntary tremor. I vomited, then I passed out. I awoke on a pallet in an upstairs room, too frightened to move after realizing that I still had no memory. My head ached, but when I rubbed it, I withdrew my hands in shock. My long hair had been cut short. I had been scrubbed pink, and my skin was tender under the coarse brown shirt that covered me. My stomach turned from the scent of unfamiliar food rising up the open stairway from the kitchen below. My thumb pacified me, and I soothed myself as I studied the room. Clothes hung from pegs on the wall, and a pole bed stood off to one side with a small plain chest next to it. Sun streamed through a window, open and undraped, and from the outdoors came the sudden peal of a child's laughter. It rang familiar, and forgetting all else, I sprang to the window. The brightness stung so that I needed both hands to shade my eyes. First, all I saw was rolling green, but below the window I saw a path. It cut past a large fenced-in garden and led to a log house where, on steps, sat two small dark brown girls. They were watching a scene up toward the big house. I leaned out farther and saw a towering oak. From a thick, low branch, a little girl on a swing sang out to a boy behind her. When he pushed the swing, the little girl, all blue and blonde, squealed. The tall boy laughed. There it was again, a laugh I recognized. Driven by hope, I ran down the wooden stairs, out the open door of the kitchen and up the hill to them. The boy pulled the swing to a stop, and the two gaped at me. Both had deep blue eyes and both exuded vibrant health.
Who are you? Where did you come from? the boy asked, his yellow hair glinting in the bright light. I could only stare back, dumb in my disappointment. I did not know him.
I'm Marshall,
the boy tried again.
And this is my sister, Sally.
I'm 4, said Sally. How old are you?
She tapped the air with her blue shoes and peeked out at me from under the flopping brim of a white bonnet. I couldn't find a voice to answer, so I felt a rush of gratitude for Marshall when he pulled the attention away from me by jiggling the swing.
How old am I?
He asked his sister.
You're 2, said Sally,
trying to poke at him with her foot.
No, I'm not.
Marshall laughed.
I'm 11.
No, you're 2,
teased Sally, enjoying a familiar game. Suddenly I was swooped up in Belle's arms.
Come back in, she said sharply. You stay with me.
Inside the kitchen house, Belle set me on a corner pallet opposite a dark brown woman who was suckling a baby. I stared, hungry at the intimacy. The mother looked at me, and although her face was young, she had deep lines around her eyes.
What your name?
She asked. When I didn't answer, she continued.
This be my baby, Henry,
she said.
And I his mama, Dory.
The baby suddenly pulled back from her breast and gave a high, shrill cry. I jammed my thumb into my mouth and shrank back. Not knowing what was expected of me, I stayed put on a pallet in the kitchen. In those first days, I studied Belle's every move. I had no appetite, and when she insisted that I eat, my stomach emptied violently. Each time I was sick, it meant another cleaning. As Belle's frustration with me grew, so did my fear of upsetting her. At night, I slept on a pallet in a corner of Belle's upstairs room. On the second night, unable to sleep, I went to stand at Belle's bedside, comforted by the sound of her soft night breathing. I must have frightened her, for when she woke, she shouted at me to get back to my own bed. I scurried back, more afraid than ever. The dark haunted me. And with each passing night, I sank further into loss. My head throbbed with the struggle of trying to remember something of myself. Thankfully, relief from my sorrow came just before sunup, when the roosters and the horn called everyone to rise. Then another woman, Mama May, joined Belle in the kitchen. The two women worked easily together, but I soon sensed that though Belle was in charge of the kitchen, Mama May was in charge of Belle. Mama May was a woman of size, although nothing about her was soft. She was a sober woman who moved like a current, and her quickness made it plain that she did not suffer idleness. She gripped a corncob pipe between her tobacco-stained teeth. It was seldom lit, though she chewed the stem, and after time I decided that it served the same purpose to her that my thumb did to me. I might have been more frightened of her had she not given me an early benediction of her smile. Then her dark brown face, her flat features, and her black eyes wrinkled into kindness. In the days that followed, I no longer tried to eat and slept most of the time. On the morning Mama May examined me, Belle watched from across the room.
She just being stubborn. When I get her to eat, she just brings it up. So now I'm only giving her water. She'll get hungry soon enough,
Belle said. Mama held my face in her strong hand.
Belle, she said sharply. This child not fighting you. She too sick. You got to get her to eat, or you gonna lose her.
I don't know why the captain give her to me. I got enough work.
Belle, you ever think maybe when I first find out they moving you to the kitchen house, I think that way about you?
Well, I sure wasn't making a mess throwing up all over you.
No, but you was about the same age, maybe 6, 7 years at the time. And you was born and raised here, and you still carried on.
Mama May scolded. Belle was silent, but following that, she was less brusque with me. Later that day, Mama May killed a chicken. She made a broth for me, and for the first time my stomach tolerated something other than water. After some days of this healing liquid, I began to eat and then to retain solid food. When I became more alert again, Belle began to quiz me. Finally, summoning all of my courage, I managed to convey that I had no memory. Whether it was my foreign accent or Belle's surprise at my information, I do not know, but she stared at me, disbelieving. To my enormous relief, she didn't question me further. Then, just as things began to settle, Belle and I were called to the big house. Belle was nervous. She fussed at me with a comb, until in frustration she finally wrapped my head in a scarf to cover the chopped mess that was my hair. I was dressed in a fresh brown shirt that fell below my knees, over which Belle tied a white apron that she had stitched hastily from a kitchen cloth. "Don't suck your thumb." Belle pulled my swollen finger from my mouth. She stooped down to my level and forced me to meet her eyes.
"When she asks you anything, you say yes, ma'am. That's all you say, yes, ma'am. Do you understand?"
I understood little of what was expected, but I nodded, eager to still Belle's anxiety. I followed closely behind Belle on the brick path that led us up to the back porch. Uncle Jacob nodded solemnly while holding open the door.
"Clean those feet," he said.
I stopped to brush fine dirt and sand from my bare feet, then felt the smoothness of the highly polished wood as I stepped across the threshold. Far ahead, the front door was open, and a light breeze swept down the long hallway past me and out the open back door. That first morning, I did not note the mahogany high boy standing sentry in the hall, nor did I see the tall blue and white talipier displayed proudly as the latest expense from across the sea. I remember very clearly, though, the terror I felt as I was led to the dining room.
"Well, here they are,"
the captain's voice boomed. At the sight of me, little Sally squealed.
"Look, Marshall, it's that girl from the kitchen. Can I play with her, Mama?"
"You stay away from her," the woman said.
"She looks sick. James, whatever."
"Steady, Martha. I had no choice. The parents died, and they owed me passage. Either she came with me or I had to indenture her out. She was sick. I would have got nothing for her."
"Was she alone?"
"No, she had a brother, but he was easy enough to place."
"Why'd you put her in the kitchen house?"
Marshall asked.
"What else could I do?" his father replied. "She has to be trained for some use."
"But why with her?"
Marshall nodded toward Belle.
"That's enough, son,"
the captain said, waving me forward.
"Come here, come here."
Though now clean-shaven and dressed as a gentleman, I recognized him as the one who had lifted me from the wagon. He was not a tall man, but his overall size and his loud voice put forth a large presence. His gray hair was tied in the back, and his deep blue eyes peered at us over spectacles. The captain looked past me.
"How are you, Belle?" he asked.
"Fine, Captain," she replied softly.
"You look fine,"
he said, and his eyes smiled at her.
"Of course she's fine, James. Why wouldn't she be fine? Look at her, such a beautiful girl. She wants for nothing, head of a kitchen at her young age and practically owning her own fine house. You have your pick of beaux, don't you, Belle?"
The woman spoke quickly in a high voice, leaning her elbow on the table as she pulled repeatedly at an escaped strand of her red hair.
"Don't you, Belle? Don't they come and go?" she asked insistently.
"Yes, ma'am."
Belle's voice was strained.
"Come, come,"
the captain interrupted, and again waved me forward, closer to him. I focused on the deep lines that creased his weathered face when he smiled.
"Are you helping in the kitchen?" he asked.
"Yes, ma'am,"
I croaked, anxious to follow Belle's instruction. The room exploded in laughter, though I saw that the boy, Marshall,
did not laugh.
She said yes, ma'am, to you, Daddy,
Sally giggled. The captain chuckled.
Do I look like a ma'am to you?
Uncertain of my answer, for I did not understand this unfamiliar form of address, I anxiously nodded. Again, there was laughter. Suddenly the captain turned, and his voice boomed.
Fanny, Beatty, slow down, you'll blow us out of the room.
It was then I noticed the two small dark-skinned girls and remembered them from the first day when they had been seated on the steps of the cabin. Through kitchen conversation I had learned that they were Mama May's 6-year-old twins. Now they stood on the other side of the table, each pulling a cord. The cords were attached to a large fan suspended from the ceiling that, when pulled, flapped over the dining room table like the wing of a gigantic butterfly, thereby creating a draft. With the excitement of the laughter, their enthusiasm was overventilating the room, but after the shout from the captain, their dark eyes grew solemn, and their pulling slowed. The captain turned back.
Belle,
he said,
you've done well. You've kept her alive.
He glanced down at some papers before him and spoke directly to me after skimming a page.
Let's see. You'll soon be 7 years old, is that right?
I didn't know. In the silence, Sally chirped up.
I'm 4 years old.
That will do, Sally,
Martha said. She sighed, and the captain winked at his wife. When he removed his spectacles to better study me, I felt faint under his scrutiny.
Don't you know your age? Your father was a school teacher, didn't he teach you numbers?
My father, I thought. I have a father.
When you feel stronger, I want you to work in the kitchen, he said. Can you do that?
My chest ached, and I was finding it difficult to breathe, but I nodded.
Good, he said. Then we'll keep you here until you've grown.
He paused.
Do you have any questions?
My need to know surpassed my terror. I leaned closer to him. My name, I managed to whisper.
What? What do you mean, your name?
He asked. Belle spoke quickly.
She don't know her name.
The captain looked at Belle as though for an explanation. When none was forthcoming, he looked down again at the papers before him. He coughed before he answered.
It says here your name is Lavinia. Lavinia McCotton.
I clung to the information as though it were a life raft. I don't remember leaving the room, but I surfaced on a pallet in the kitchen to overhear Uncle and Belle discussing the captain. He was leaving again in the morning, Belle said, and she was expecting a visit from him that evening.
You gonna ask for those papers?
Uncle Jacob questioned. Belle didn't answer.
You tell him that you needs them now. Miss Martha got her eye on you. The captain knows she take the black drops, but he don't know that she drink the peach liquor with it. You get more pretty by the day. And after all that drinking, when Miss Martha pick up that mirror, she see that she looking more than her 30 years. She out to get you, and time goes on. It only get worse.
Belle's usual determined voice was subdued.
But, Uncle, I don't want to go. This place my home. You all my family.
Belle, you know you got to go,
he said. Their conversation ended when Uncle Jacob saw my open eyes.
Well. Lil' Lavinia, wake up.
He said. Belle came over to me.
Lavinia,
she said, pushing my hair from my forehead.
That name sounds like you.
I stared at her, then turned my face away. I was more lost than ever, for I felt no connection to that name. The next evening I was sent home with Mama May. I didn't want to leave the kitchen house, but Belle insisted.
Mama said that her twins, Fanny and Beatty, the two girls I had seen working the fan, would be there with me. On the walk over, Mama May held my hand and pointed out how the kitchen house was just a short distance from her own small cabin. Fanny and Beatty were there to greet us. I hung back, wanting to stay next to Mama May, but the girls were eager for a new playmate. They drew me into a corner of the small cabin to a shelf that had been carved into one of the logs where their treasures were kept. The taller of the two, Fanny was the leader, with her mother's quick eyes and direct speech. Her arms and legs were like those of a colt. Beatty was short and plump, pretty already, with a broad smile emphasized by two deep dimples.
"Look,"
Fanny instructed me as she withdrew toys from the shelf. She handed down a doll-sized table with two chairs, constructed of small twigs held together with bits of animal sinew. Beatty showed me her doll, then offered it to me to hold. I grabbed for it with such hunger that Beatty hesitated until her generous spirit won out and she released it.
"Mama make her,"
she said with pride, looking back to Mama May. I gripped Beatty's prize, my heart pierced with longing. The doll was made of rough brown cloth, her eyes were stitched in black thread, while black wool stood out in braids. I fingered the doll's shirt, styled like the one the twins and I wore. She wore a red apron, and I recognized it as the same fabric as Mama May's headscarf. As dark descended, Dory and Baby Henry joined us. They had frequently visited the kitchen house, where I had learned that Dory was Mama May's eldest daughter. I liked Dory well enough, for she left me alone, but I wasn't fond of the baby with his harsh cry. Although distracted by the girls and their play, I kept a close eye on Mama's reassuring presence. When the door suddenly opened, a huge, dark bear of a man stood framed against the even blacker night sky. I flew to Mama's side. Fanny and Beatty scrambled to their feet and ran to the man, who scooped them up.
"Papa!"
they cried. After he released them, they went back to their play, and with Mama's encouragement, I joined them.
"Evening, Dory."
The man's voice was so deep, he might have been underground, and when he paused by Baby Henry's Mama, his large hand covered the top of her head.
"How your little one doing?"
"Not so good, Papa,"
Dory answered, not looking up from the bench where she sat nursing her infant. The child fussed when she gently pulled his swollen hands out to show her father.
"When his hands get big like this, he cry all the time," she said.
Her father leaned down and with a knuckle gently stroked the baby's cheek. When he straightened, he sighed and then took a few giant strides across the floor to Mama May. The girls giggled and hid their eyes when their father reached for Mama, pulling her to him and playfully nuzzling her neck.
"George,"
Mama laughed, then shooed him off. When he stepped back, he caught my eye and nodded at me. I quickly turned away. Belle was expecting a visitor, Mama May said to the man, as though to explain my presence, and the pair exchanged a look before Mama May turned back to the fireplace. She scooped out stew from a black pot that hung over the open fire, and Papa set the filled wooden bowls on the narrow table. Then she brushed the coals from the top lid of another black iron pot that was nestled in hot ash, and from it she removed a steaming round corn cake, browned to crispness around the edges. The three adults pulled up small stools to the table, and Fanny and Beatty had me stand between them as they began to eat. But everything felt strange, and I wanted the familiarity of the kitchen house. With no appetite, I studied the food, and when Mama instructed me to eat, I began to cry.
"Come here, Binya,"
she said, and after I went to her, she hoisted me onto her lap.
"Child, you got to eat. You need some meat on them bones. Here, I dip this into the gravy for you, and you eat so you get strong as Mama."
The twins laughed.
"You treating her just like a baby, Mama," Fanny said.
"Well,"
Mama said,
"maybe she my new baby, and I got to feed her. Now you open your mouth, little baby.
I so wanted her mothering that I ate the cornbread she dipped into the thick ham gravy. She continued to feed me as she spoke of the captain leaving and how Miss Martha's nerves were running over again. Dory said she had to go back up to the big house tonight. No telling what Miss Martha would do when the captain left in the morning. Mama May said how she wished she could go stay with Miss Martha so Dory could stay with baby Henry. Dory answered with a deep sigh.
You know it's me she be wantin'.
And Mama agreed. We had almost finished the meal when we heard muffled voices from the outside. Papa George began to rise, and my stomach clenched when Mama quickly set me aside.
No, George, she said, standing. Me and Dory go. Won't do nobody no good to throw another man in this stew pot.
I heard footsteps coming at a run, and when the door flew open, Belle came in gasping for air. Her green head rag was missing, and her usual night braid was undone. Mama May pulled Belle inside before she and Dory rushed out. Belle leaned against the wall, panting, then straightened herself before walking over to the table where she sat across from Papa. Belle said,
She comes down after him this time. She never do that before. And Marshall, he comes with her. When she sees the new comb and the book he gives me, she takes them up and throws them at me. That starts Marshall pushing and hitting on me. The captain grabs him and sends him out the door, but then Miss Martha starts crying and hitting on him. He says, Martha, Martha, get a hold of yourself, but she's so worked up, he tells me to go get Mama.
Belle put her elbows on the table and rested her head in her hands. Papa shook his head.
Did you ask for the free papers?
He asked. Belle spoke through her fingers.
He says I'll get them next summer.
The air clicked with Papa's anger, and when he stood he pushed back the table with such force that two of the wooden bowls flew to the floor.
Next year. Next year, always the next time. Something's gonna happen here if he don't get you those papers.
When the door closed behind him, I was more surprised than anyone that my supper came up without warning. With it, though, I felt some relief, as my involuntary action seemed to refocus Belle and steady her while she cleaned me. The twins watched from their pallet, the sleeping baby Henry beside them. After Belle finished with me, she set me with them, then straightened the room. When everything was in order, Belle came to us, eased the sleeping baby into her arms and nodded for me to join her. We were all startled to hear a loud thunking sound from outside, but as it continued, Fanny identified the source.
Papa chopping his wood again, she whispered.
When we left for Belle's house, white moonlight offered only shadow on the far side of the cabin where Papa worked.
Papa? Belle called softly. Papa!
The pounding stopped.
Papa, don't worry. I get the papers,
she said into the silence.
Chapter 2. Belle. Mama says, one more time, the captain home just long enough to get the place upside down. And she's right, like always. What's he doing giving me this sick child? During the day she can't keep her food down, and at night she scares me, sitting there in the dark looking off. Course the captain is known for this, coming and going, telling nobody nothing. That's the way he always is, says Mama. She is right, 'cause I know what she knows. When I was little, when I was living up at the big house, I'd wait at the front door for his carriage, and sure enough he comes riding up the back way, sitting on a horse. Next time I wait for the horse, he comes pulling a loaded up cart. I'd never know when he was coming, and I'd never know how he'd come. For sure, though, always, one way or another, he shows up. Back then, my white grandma, Mrs. Pike, was running this place. The captain's daddy died early on. He fell off a horse. Grandma said. The captain was just a little boy, 9 years old, and he was hit hard. So the next year, Mrs. Pike sent him to school, to London, hoping he'd be a lawyer. But when he come home at 19, all he wanted was to get back on the water. Why don't he stay?
I asked her every time he left, and she'd say he has his business with his ship, so he's doing his part to keep this place going.
When he did come home, she'd always tell him everything is fine here. She didn't say anything about him staying to help with the place. Mrs. Pike raised me in the big house and taught me everything, just like a white girl. She even shows me how to read and write. She says there's no reason to act like I don't know better just because I'm half Negro. We sit at the table, her and me, with Mama May bringing in the food. Mrs. Pike shows me how to use a napkin and to sit up straight. She takes me out riding with her to see that the fields got worked. Then one day, just like every other, I go to wake her. There she is, passed on without saying goodbye. I screamed and cried until I can't no more. For 7 years, that woman was like my whole world. After she's gone, the captain, old already and never been married, decides to bring home a young wife, 20 years to his 40. They moved me out of the big house because the captain don't want Miss Martha to know about me. Down in the kitchen house, Mama May don't care that the captain is my daddy. She tells me it won't do me no good and maybe even makes it harder if I hold it up for anybody to see. You learn to cook, she says. That way they don't get rid of you. Time passes and I do like Mama says, but that don't mean I think the captain is doing right by me. This time, Dory and Mama say it's going to take a long time before Miss Martha settles down. But then she always takes it hard when the captain leaves. Of course, almost every time he comes home, she gets caught with a baby. Trouble is, those babies don't live too long. She's buried two already. Each time another one comes and goes, she takes more of those drops. Once the captain is gone, Miss Martha just stays up in that house, wandering around from room to room. Then, too, soon as his daddy goes, Marshall gets back to pestering me, throwing rocks when I'm working in the garden. He's a sly one. He only acts up when nobody sees him. I know he's thinking that I'm the problem with his mama. Sometimes I wonder what would happen if I'd sit him down and say, "Hey, boy, do you know you are throwing rocks at your big sister?" But I guess that's the captain's business. Against everything that's right, I've got to cook for Miss Martha and my brother and sister up in the big house. And sometimes, especially when the captain's home, I get to thinking how wrong this is. Then, watch out! Pots go flying all over the place. I'm 18 now and old enough to know what I want. This kitchen house is my home, and no matter what, I'm not leaving here for nobody. I don't care what they say. I don't want no free papers. They're just a way for the captain to get me out of here.
Chapter 3. Lavinia. When Belle found Beatty's stolen doll under my upstairs pallet, she was furious and insisted I take it down to the kitchen immediately.
"Why you take this?"
Mama May asked when I handed it to her. I cowered, my thumb in my mouth. "I told you she's a sly," Belle began.
"Belle."
Mama checked her.
"This be Beatty's best thing," she said sternly to me.
Unable to stand her anger, I ran out to the back of the kitchen house and hid myself behind the woodpile for the rest of the morning. Later I crept back in, up the stairs, and fell asleep while I waited for Mama May to leave. I wouldn't come down until the next morning, when Mama May called for me in a voice that wouldn't accept no. Slowly I descended the stairs to where the twins waited beside their mother. Beatty stepped forward to hand me a package wrapped in a kitchen cloth. Inside was a doll that had red braids and a body made of white cloth. It wore a brown dress and an apron made from the same green calico as Belle's head rag.
"Mama make her for you," Fanny offered.
I held the doll, afraid to believe Fanny, and looked to Mama May. She nodded.
"Now you got something of your own," she said.
By July of that first year, my health was returning, though my memory was not. I was quiet but encouraged to speak, as everyone found my Irish dialect amusing. My appearance was often a topic of discussion. Fanny hoped that the freckles across my nose would fill in to give my pale skin more color. Beatty was always trying to fluff my red hair over my pointed ears, and even Belle commented on my oddly colored amber eyes. When Mama overheard their criticisms, she told me not to worry, assuring me that one day I would grow into myself. By this time I was devoted to Mama, and I lived for her notice of me. I kept a distance from Belle, sharing her rooms but watching her closely. She saw to my care, but she was no more at ease with me than I was with her. During the day, Mama encouraged me to go off with the girls. We often went down to the barns where Papa George worked, and there I met their older brother, Ben. He was Belle's age, 18, and even larger in stature than his father. Because of his great size, I might easily have been frightened by him, but I became enamored. Ben was an outgoing man, with a hearty, deep laugh, and I watched in envy as he gently teased his little sisters. He must have taken pity on me, for he soon included me, calling me a little bird. How could I fly with my thumb in my mouth, he wanted to know. After that comment, determined to please him, I made certain to keep my hand away from my face when in his presence. Following my first introduction, my one request to the twins every morning was to go down to see Ben. The girls teased me, and when Belle overheard, she asked, "You like Ben?" Though embarrassed, I nodded. She smiled at me, the first time ever. "At least you got good sense," she said. I began to keep aside a bit of my evening meal, and in the morning I could hardly wait to give Ben my offering. He never failed to show surprise, and always ate it with a great show of pleasure. One day in return, Ben presented me with a bird nest he had found. All the riches in the world couldn't have bought it from me. It was to become the first in my collection of abandoned bird nests. I carefully placed it on the floor beside my pallet, next to my treasured doll. The twins and I were playing by the stream the afternoon Jimmy, a young man from the quarters, stole the board. We didn't know how to swim, so we waded knee-high near the mossy bank, tossing white water into the air and twirling into it, finally exhausting ourselves. We were resting on the stream bank when Fanny's finger suddenly went to her lips to quiet us. We followed her as she crept into the thick bushes and parted the leaves to see a young, dark Negro man a short distance downstream, crouched in the shade of the springhouse. That building, I knew, held cooled butter and cheese and often some puddings, and my first thought, when I noted his thin, bare chest, was that he looked hungry. He glanced back and forth, and seeing no one, sprinted up to the next building, the smokehouse, which held the year's supply of meat. A pungent scent of hickory smoke seeped from the building, where it permeated the heavily salted pork and beef cuts hanging from the beams inside. Fanny and Beatty both sucked in their breath when the man undid the latch and entered. Beatty whispered that it should have been locked, and that Papa George carried the key. We watched until we saw him again. He left, but not with meat. Instead, he had a board under his arm. It appeared to be a floorboard about 3 feet long. He ran back to the cover of the springhouse, then, after a short pause, turned and dashed through the woods, down the hill, in the direction of the quarters. I ran after the girls when they went for Papa George. We found him with Mama May in the chicken pen, helping her catch a hen. As we rounded the corner, he caught one and held the squawking bird by its feet.
"Papa," Fanny called as we ran up to him. "Papa, Jimmy from the quarters take another board from the smokehouse."
Mama May took the chicken from Papa and walked to the back of the coop. The three of us followed as Papa and Mama May began to argue.
"This has got to stop," hissed Mama.
"They needs the salt," Papa said.
He left then, and Mama May furiously plunked the chicken on the wood block. She turned to look at the three of us.
"You saw nothing," she said,
before she lifted a small axe and with one blow chopped off the chicken's head. She flung the chicken's body to the ground as blood pumped from its neck. The head lay severed while the body stayed on its feet, terrifying me with its morbid death dance. I turned and ran for the kitchen house, passing Papa George, who was headed for the smokehouse with a replacement board. Belle was in the kitchen yard, tending a large pot of boiling water over an outdoor fire. I surprised both her and myself when I ran and clung to the safety of her skirts. When Mama May followed, I was relieved to see that the chicken, hanging upside down in Mama's grip, was now still. I stayed next to Belle and watched Mama dip the bird in the scalding water. When she pulled it out, she did not wait for it to cool before plucking the feathers. I thought she was angry, but after she'd eviscerated the chicken, she called me over to see how the insides held a perfectly formed egg.
"See? No reason to get so scared," she said. "Mama just killing a chicken."
Then she gave me the egg to have for my supper. It was still warm. A few weeks later, I went with the girls down to see the children in the quarters. The twins were forbidden to visit without their mother, but Fanny, already rebellious, convinced Beattie and me to go with her. The quarters were set up far down the hill, alongside the stream. Coming from the woods, we approached the cabins from the backside, where attached lean-tos sheltered stacks of split wood. The cabins were built of rough-hewn logs and chinked with mud. Each had two doors with a wall in the center of the cabin that created two separate homes. When we peeked in one, the room looked small. Pallets were piled in the corner, and a large black iron pot stood alongside the fireplace. Wooden spoons hung from pegs on the wall, and worn rags were draped over a piece of rope strung across the room. Under a small open window, flies buzzed, searching unsuccessfully for crumbs on the homemade table and the wooden bowls stacked there. Fanny said this was where Jimmy and his many brothers lived. With her fingers, she named each of them.
"Ida, his mama, and she have this many boys."
She smiled, holding up six fingers. We heard children and followed the sound. It led us past a number of double cabins and several small gardens. When we rounded the final cabin, we found ourselves in a large dirt yard. Down a distance was a clapboard house, and Beattie whispered that this was where the overseer lived, away from the others.
"He white," she said in my ear.
From the center of the yard, an old woman called out a greeting.
"Well, well, it the Fanny and the Beattie."
She straightened up, her thin rounded back as best she could, and continued to stir the contents of a black kettle that bubbled over an open flame.
"You's here to eat?" she asked.
A group of children stood back from her, watching carefully.
"No, Auntie, we got to go right back up," Fanny said.
"And who dis?"
The old woman's dark eyes peered at me.
"This a Binya, Auntie. Belle, her new mama,"
Fanny answered. I glanced at Fanny, wondering at the title she'd given Belle.
"Ma-ha,"
replied the old woman, looking me up and down before turning back to her work. She called over two of the boys to help her remove the pot from the fire and set it on the side to cool. When she took a large wooden paddle to stir the cornmeal again, I caught a pleasant waft of the salty smell of pork, but I was surprised to see her stir up a piece of board from the bottom. She looked about carefully before removing it, then threw it quickly on the fire. I'm not sure how I knew, but I was aware that this was a piece of the board from Jimmy's smokehouse theft. With the help of the boys, she poured the hot meal into a wooden trough, not unlike the one Papa George used for his pigs. A tall girl emptied a small wooden bucketful of buttermilk over the stiffening corn mush, and the old woman used her cooking paddle to combine the two. When she nodded to the children, they rushed eagerly to their meal. A few of the babies clung to their older siblings and were settled on a lap or placed at the trough, where they all began to eat. Some of the children had thin pieces of wood to help scoop up the food, though most used nothing but unwashed hands, and the yellow mixture soon turned dark. When I saw their hunger, I was struck with a deep familiarity and turned away, my mind anxious to keep at bay memories it was not yet ready to recall. we were back at the kitchen house in time for our own afternoon meal. That day, our wooden bowls contained a roasted sweet potato, a generous slice of boiled ham, and an ear of sweet corn. I felt guilt as I began to eat, remembering the children we had just left. But the cause of my guilt soon changed when I heard Fanny lie to Mama May about where we had spent the afternoon. As cold weather approached, our responsibilities grew. The girls were taken up to the big house to learn from Mama, while I was kept down with Belle. When Fanny balked at the housework, Mama sat her down in the kitchen house, and with an earshot of Beatty and me, lectured her daughter.
"What you thinking, Fanny? You forgetting that you a slave. You don't know by now, any time the captain want, he can sell you. Any time Miss Martha say she want you gone, you gone."
"I just say no, I'm staying," Fanny sassed.
Mama's voice shook.
"You listen, girl. I'm gonna tell you what happens when you say no to a white man. I watch my own daddy get shot when he saddle up and ride out on a mule to get help for my own sick mama. She having a baby, crying out for help. I standing right there when that master say to my daddy to get down from that mule. When my daddy say no, I's going for help, that old master shoot him in the back. That night, all I know to do is keep the flies away when I watch my mama die. When that old master sell me, he say I'm good for nothing but the fields. And that's where I grow up, working hard, right alongside Ida, until old Mrs. Pike call me up to the big house to feed Bill. It don't take long for me to see what I got to do to stay up there. I work for Mrs. Pike like I don't know what tired mean. Nothing that I won't do. Yes, Mrs. Pike, you right, Mrs. Pike. That all I say. You girls, watch me close. I act like I don't have no mind of my own, except how to make everybody in the big house happy. That because I mean to stay up there, and I trying hard to keep you girls with me. There's not a day go by that I don't say thank you, Lord, for sending me up to the big house and for giving me the captain for my master. I know there's nothing right about being a slave, but who are gonna tell that story to? Now, Fanny, you still wanting to get yourself sold? You ask Papa how he got here. Then you get yourself ready, because he gonna cry when he tell you, and by the time he finish, you be crying too.
Wide-eyed, the three of us had nothing to say when Mama finished. Later that month, the twins told me of a new arrival, another adult, who had come to join the family. He was from England, a tutor, they said, sent by the captain to teach his children. When Fanny declared that she didn't like him, I don't remember asking her why. I was certainly curious about the big house and the children in it, but the girls told me that they did not often see the inhabitants. If they should, they were instructed not to initiate conversation, but to nod and go about their tasks. When Beatty supported Fanny in saying that their work, dusting and cleaning floors, was tedious and unexciting, I ceased to mind that I was kept back in the kitchen. Belle was softening toward me, and as she did, I became even more eager to please her. It was already my responsibility to scatter the corn and wheat for the chickens, so I was doubly proud of myself the day she trusted me to go down to the chicken house to collect the eggs. When Papa George saw me leaving the henyard, he came my way. Eager to shine at my new responsibility, I painstakingly placed my full basket on the ground before carefully closing the gate behind me.
"You good with the hens, been you?"
he said.
"You a good girl."
His smile radiated through to my lonely heart and suddenly opened it to a new possibility. "Papa," I asked, "is Dora your girl?"
"That she is,"
Papa said. "Are Beatty and Fanny your girls?" I asked.
"They sure enough is,"
he said. "Papa," I asked, "is Belle your girl?"
"Why you ask all this, child?" he said.
"I was wondering, Papa," I said, then stopped and focused on my toe as it drew a line in the dirt.
Go on, child, what you wondering about?
He encouraged. Could I be your girl, too? I asked quickly. The large, broad-shouldered man looked away before he answered.
Well, now,
he said, as though he had given it deep thought.
I sure do think I would like that.
But, I said, concerned that he hadn't noticed, I don't look like your other girls.
You mean because you white?
I nodded.
Obinya,
he said, pointing toward the chickens.
You look at those birds. Some of them be brown, some of them be white and black. Do you think when they little chicks, those mamas and papas care about that?
I smiled up at him, and he rested his huge hand on my head.
I think I just got me one more baby girl,
he said, tasseling my hair.
And I'm gonna call her Obinya. How about that? I say, thank you, Lord. Ain't I just the luckiest man?
I skipped all the way back up to the house. Belle scolded me when she found a broken egg, and I promised her that I would be more careful the next time, but my singing heart wasn't apologetic in the least. A light snow was falling the early December night when Mama May brought the shrieking baby Henry to the warm kitchen. The twins followed her, and we three sat together and watched as Belle and Mama May applied warm soaks to the baby's swollen feet and hands, but he would not stop his agonized screams.
Fanny, you go up to get Dory. Miss Martha taking the black drops all day, and for sure she's sleeping by now. Uncle Jacob, keep an eye on her till Dory get back.
Fanny turned to run, and Mama called after her.
Tell Dory to bring the black drops with her.
When Dory arrived, she tried to comfort her baby by nursing him. In his pain, he refused the solace, tossing his head back and forth. Dory herself began to cry.
Mama, what can I do?
He not good, baby.
Mama May said to her oldest daughter,
I see this before down the quarters. We give the drops to ease him.
Mama held the little brown bottle Dory had brought from the house and mixed some of the dark liquid with warm water. Dory held the suffering child while Belle opened his mouth, and Mama carefully dripped the mixture in. Baby Henry coughed when he swallowed, but to our great relief he soon fell into a deep sleep. Later there was a light knock, and Uncle Jacob entered.
"Miss Martha calling for you, Dory," he said. "She want you now."
Mama May took baby Henry from a reluctant Dory.
"Go on," she said. "He gonna sleep now."
After Dory left, Mama showed Uncle Jacob the baby's swollen hands and feet. He shook his head.
"He not gonna be here long," he said. "This be hard on Dory," said Mama May.
"Hard on Jimmy, too," Belle added. "Don't forget he's the daddy. Every day all he wants to see is his Dory and his baby boy, but he's got to stay away. The overseer warned Jimmy that if he finds him close to Dory again, he'll sell him. He says Jimmy's a field worker, so he's got to go with a field woman, and he's not supposed to have nothing to do with a big house girl."
"Don't nobody ask the cap'n if Dory can jump the broom with Jimmy?"
Uncle Jacob asked.
"Rankin say he the overseer. That mean he the boss, and he say who marry who,"
answered Mama May.
"That Rankin just wantin' to be ugly."
When Mama May took notice of the three of us, the twins were sent home, and I was sent upstairs to sleep. After Uncle left, Mama May stayed with the baby and sat beside the fire to talk with Belle. I fell asleep, comforted by their soft, low voices. Baby Henry died that night. In the early morning, Papa George came with a small board over which Mama and Belle fashioned a small pallet. Dory stood near the door, holding her now quiet baby. Mama went to her.
"Give him to me," she said softly, reaching for baby Henry.
"Mama, no."
Dory turned away with her bundle. Papa George came over and put his arm around the thin shoulders of his firstborn daughter.
"Dory, he okay now. He with the Lord. You give him to Mama."
Slowly, Dory held baby Henry out.
Mama, you fix him. You always so good with him, Mama, she pleaded.